Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show planned for you today. I actually have a quick last-minute switch. My original guest for today, Lier Keith, has gotten sick, and so she will not be joining us. So my guest today will be Nancy Romer, who was going to be coming on in a few weeks, and instead we switched things around. She's going to be joining me this morning. And Nancy, I'll tell you more about her in a little while, but she's been working with the Sandy 5 grassroots organization to plan a march. That's going to be really exciting, and I will tell you more about that in just a little bit. But first, I want to go over some things going on in and around the news. This has been such a crazy week. I mean, of course, starting with the Las Vegas shootings, you have to step back and just take a look at what's going on and wonder what is going on. I mean, what will it take for our elected officials to get behind protecting people against gun violence as opposed to protecting industries and the NRA and, you know, gun-loving Americans? I mean, we really need to step back. I know this show is on food, and so I don't want to get too much onto a tangent, but I did want to ask you all to take your political savvy and let your elected officials know that you want protection, and you want there to be legislation enacted that will protect us from people being able to buy guns, getting guns into the hands of not just criminals, obviously, because this man had no criminal record, had no mental illness. He was just a regular, retired, gambling American. But for whatever reason, and they don't know yet, he just went crazy. And we need to keep guns out of everybody's hands because of people like him and other people that are just, you know, that just lose it in a flash, in a moment. And right now, believe it or not, our government officials are voting on whether or not to ban silencers. There was a motion to ban silencers, and they're trying to undo that that piece of legislation. So what I'm asking all of you to do is text the word silencers to the phone number 644-33. And this is on my website. If you don't have a pencil and can't write it down, you can go to IE Green later on and look at my homepage or my blog page. Text silencers to 644-33. And that will guide you how to get in touch with your representative to tell them to oppose this bill to promote, to ban silencers. You know, in Las Vegas, people ran because they could hear the gunshots. If no one heard the gunshots, they wouldn't have run. And they would have been sitting there like ducks waiting to be shot even more. So silencers, you know, just make sense that there's no reason for people who have a gun to have a silencer unless they're trying to do something that they don't want to be, and they don't want to be heard, which is not the purpose of guns, although I don't think they have any purpose. So I just wanted to get that off my shoulders. I also wanted to share with you, I was in contact with some of the women that I had met when I went down to Puerto Rico a few years ago, who are members of the Slow Food Youth Organization. And they are working with the sustainable farmers on the island to try to to raise money to help get these farmers back on their feet. And a couple of weeks ago when I went to a book launch of a book on land rights, you know, I was listening to Karen Washington speak, and she was talking about how, you know, she's waiting for to see what happens in the islands like Puerto Rico and Virgin Islands to see what happens with the land grabbing. Because the traditional story is you have a storm, the farmer gets wiped out, he can't sell his crops because he has no crops left. He therefore can't pay his debt. Therefore, he loses his land and it goes to the highest bidder. And this is, you know, a way history has a way of repeating itself. And we need to change that that story and try to switch it around. And so they have created a GoFundMe campaign that I think is just really, really worthwhile for everybody to get onto and to help fund the small sustainable farmers in Puerto Rico who are not getting their monthly income from selling of their crops, and we want to help them stay afloat. So if you can, think about joining this this fund. Again, the website, well, it's GoFundMe campaign, but you can find it on my website or go to Visit Rico. And Visit Rico is a nonprofit organization that's based in Puerto Rico whose mission is to strengthen their agricultural tourism through the sustainable foods and also food sovereignty. So you can go to Visit Visit Rico's website, and there you'll find the Facebook page and the GoFundMe campaign. So it's www.visitrico.org. But it's really, you know, it's times like these when we can really pull together, pull our resources together, and make a difference. So I ask you all to please do that. Green Drinks New York City is having an event on October 10th from 6:30 to 9:30 at the Ricky at the Dream down Midtown. And that's an opportunity for people to come together and network with people that are all into green professional living. So those are worth checking out if you are in a place in your life where you networking would be beneficial. It's a good place to go. October 12th through the 17th is the New York City Wine and Food Festival. 100% of the proceeds from this event goes to No Kid Hungry and the New York City Food Bank. So a worthwhile event to go to and support these wonderful organizations. October 12th, Hunter College has their food policy for breakfast once a month on Thursday mornings. These are free events. This month it will be Michael Anthony, chef from New York City and the Whitney. He's going to be on the panel with a bunch of other chefs talking about sustainability and innovative farm-to-table restaurants in New York City. So they'll be sharing their perspectives on clean eating and you know, changing menus to affect healthier eating. So that should be a wonderful thing. These events every month are really just great, so consider going to them. Like I said, they're free, and they do give out a really nice, healthy breakfast. October 13th through the 15th, there's a coffee festival in New York City, and each ticket includes as much coffee as you can drink. There's over 100 exhibitors that will be showing there. There's music, DJs, art exhibits, and lots of cocktails and street food. And 100% of these proceeds will go to Project Waterfall, which is bringing clean water to coffee-producing countries. Also a worthwhile endeavor. What else is going on? I've been talking about the tour out at Meacock's Dairy out in Bridgehampton. This is with farmer and cheesemaker Art Ludlow, and he'll be taking you behind the scenes to see how cheeses are made and how they take care of their dairy cows there. So that should be fun if you have an interest in cheesemaking. October 14th, Outside the Shell, is the Oyster and Libation Pairing Event. That is at the City Pier A, and that is being put on by Edible New York City. So check that out. October 17th, Island Harvest Food Bank is having a tasting, Long Island tasting event, and that's at the Crest Hollow Country Club. They're going to have over 40 of the best chefs on Long Island there, sampling food, spirits, and desserts. So that should be fun. October 17th, Michel Pascal, who was a guest on my show, he is a French meditation teacher, but has really been addressing people doing little meditations in their daily life, like sitting on the subway and breathing, driving in your car, breathing, recognizing that people don't have that 20 minutes twice a day to create the space. He's showing people how they can create the space wherever they are. And he's having an event at Carnegie Hall, and all the proceeds of this will be benefiting using music and sound healing for cancer patients. And that's October 17th in the Weill Recital Hall. So I'm going to go, and I hope to see many of you there. Also on October 17th, CUNY Food Policy Forum is having a forum on global food systems, and that's at the CUNY Graduate School at 125th Street, and that's an all-day event from, oh, actually, it's not. It's just in the morning from 9 to 10:30, and it's free. So you can check that out. I have so many events coming up on my website, so you should check those out. But one I do want to also tell you about is on October 21st, Slow Food North Shore, which is a slow food chapter that I have been chairing for the last 8 years. I'm stepping down so that I can work on my cookbook, which so many of you I know are anxiously awaiting for. So I'm going to be working on my book. So I'm stepping down from this, and I don't have anybody to take it over. So we're putting out a call to anybody out there who is in the mid-island of Long Island who might be interested in carrying slow food forward to step up to the plate and let me know. But in the meantime, we are having our last hurrah, our last farm-to-table celebration of the harvest. And that's going to be at the Parish Hall at St. Luke's Episcopal Church in Seacliff, which is a cute little town on Long Island on the North Shore. And it's going to, we're going to have live music, dancing, cocktail hour, and full farm-to-table dinner in slow food style. The one thing that's not slow food style is the tickets are only $25 for everybody. We really are subsidizing the tickets here so that we can make it affordable for everybody to come and make this really our last hurrah. So please come out and support Slow Food North Shore and the work that we've been doing, and celebrate us for the work we've done, and hopefully someone will step forward so Slow Food can continue. But if not, it really will be the last event of Slow Food North Shore. And like I said, check out my website for more events. October 28th is the Sandy 5 March for Awareness. And we'll be talking about that more in our show in just a little bit. But that is a really wonderful event. And on, also on October 26th is the Healthy Food Gala, which I do every year. It's a 100% plant-based food tasting gala that is sponsored by the Coalition for Healthy School Food. And this is their main fundraiser of the year. And it's a really fun event. So come on out to that. You can go onto either the Coalition of Healthy School Foods website, or you can find a link again from my website for that. And also, Food Day is coming up October 24th, and we have a couple of events for that. I'll be doing a food tasting or cooking demo at Long Island Cares, which is the Harry Chapin Food Bank, and then in the evening I'll be at an open event at the Port Washington Public Library where we'll be screening the film Ingredients, and I'll be doing a cooking demo, and that's a free event, so check that out. And like I said, all of these can be found on my website. And before I invite my guest on, I want to share with you my recipe from this week. I've shared this before, and you know, this is the time of year where people are making pumpkin pies, and this is a really unbelievably delicious, healthier alternative to your traditional pumpkin pie. And this is a vegan pumpkin pie. It's mostly raw, but I do cook the pumpkin before putting it in. So you can either use pumpkin out of the garden that you steam or roast, or you can buy really good organic canned pumpkin. And it's very much like my raw vegan cheesecakes, but it has pumpkin in it. So for the crust, I use 1 cup of macadamia nuts, 1 cup of raw almonds, 1 cup of dates, 1/2 cup of dried unsweetened coconut, 1 pinch of sea salt, and 3/4 teaspoon of ground ginger. And I mix that up into the crust, and I press that down into a tart pan that has a removable bottom so that when I want to cut it, because I keep it in the freezer, when I want to cut it, I just lift it up so that the sides are not inside of the tart pan anymore. And also with the tart pans, you have a really beautiful fluted edge. So it's very decorative and it's really pretty. So if you can get a fluted tart pan with a removable bottom, that is the ideal piece of equipment to make this with. So for the filling, you're going to soak 3 cups of cashews for about 3 hours in some cold filtered water and let that soak, and then you're going to drain those. And then you're going to mix that with 1/4 cup of lemon juice, 1 can of organic pumpkin or 2 cups of steamed pumpkin, 1 teaspoon cinnamon, 1/2 teaspoon ginger, 1/4 teaspoon ground cloves, an eighth of a teaspoon of allspice, an eighth of a teaspoon of nutmeg, a quarter teaspoon of salt, 3/4 cups of maple syrup, 3/4 cup of coconut oil, 1 tablespoon of vanilla, and 1/2 cup of water. And you're going to mix that up. I actually, this last time, I didn't even put the water in, and it was really good. So it depends on, you know, how watery your pumpkin is as to whether you want to add that 1/2 cup of water. So you can taste it and decide for yourself. And then the topping, I used 1 cup of pecans that I mixed with 1/4 cup of maple syrup. I lightly chopped the pecans first, mix it, the maple syrup in with it, and then I toast the pecans on a cookie sheet for just like 5 minutes at 350 oven just to help the maple syrup harden on top of the pecans, and it's really delicious. So you pull the crust, like I said, you press that into the tart pan, then you mix all of the filling ingredients into either a Vitamix or a Cuisinart and pulse that until it's really, really smooth. And you really want to get it as creamy and smooth as possible. You should not be able to see any lumps in there, any small pieces of the coconut oil that did not mix up. So really blend that very well, and then pour the filling right into the pan with the crust, and put that into the freezer for about an hour, and then you can add the pecan topping on top of that. And that's it. Put it back into the freezer and pull it out just about 15 minutes or so before you want to serve it. And then remove the tart bottom from the outline of the tart pan and slice away. And it's delicious. So as always, I love the feedback. So please let me know how you like it. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you Nancy Romer. Nancy is a lifelong activist. She's been involved in so many different things. She served in the Peace Corps in Colombia, and when she came back to the U.S., she joined the anti-war movement for Vietnam. And she's been working in peace and social justice ever since. She's a feminist, anti-racist. She's worked in public higher education, was a professor at Brooklyn College for 42 years, and retired 2 years ago. She helped start the Brooklyn College Community Partnership that serves over 1,500 youth each semester from underserved Brooklyn high schools and middle schools, using art as a way to advance development. She was a founder of the Brooklyn Food Coalition, and she was on the steering committee for the People's Climate March, and now she's on the steering committee for Sandy 5, which is a grassroots organization demanding that our elected officials protect us from the dangers of climate change. And I'm going to let her tell us more about that right now. Sandy, you with me?
I am with you.
Thank you so much for, joining me last minute. I know it can be a little crazy sometimes, but I really appreciate you coming on and talking to us about what you've been involved in. It sounds really exciting.
You know, we're gearing up for a big march that's going to be, I hate to throw a number out because, you know, you want it to be even more, but we're hoping to have at least 10,000 people on October 28th. It's the day before the 5th anniversary of Superstorm Sandy. And we are using that opportunity to galvanize the city around climate policy that has urgency behind it. I think the events of the last few weeks with the 3 major hurricanes, and the hurricane season hasn't really hit New York yet because the hurricanes that come up the Atlantic coast are more likely to happen in October, as we know from Superstorm Sandy. Mm-hmm. But we're going to be experiencing extreme weather consistently from now on, no matter what we do. We can't stop the extreme weather, but we can stop the pace of climate change by urgent action on the part of the city and the state. We know we cannot rely on the federal government anymore, but we do know that people have the capacity to press their city and state governments to be more proactive on climate policy. So we are so fortunate to have over 70 organizations participate in sponsoring this big march. Just to give you a couple of facts about what the details of the march will be, you know, the logistics. We're going to be meeting on Saturday morning of October 28th at 11 o'clock. We're going to be starting off at Cadman Plaza in Brooklyn Heights. That's on the Brooklyn side of the Brooklyn Bridge. We're going to be marching over the Brooklyn Bridge and going to the Smith NYCHA housing, Smith Public Housing, and that's at 21 St. James Place, right off Pearl Street. So it's not a long march, but it's a symbolic march. And we're going to have contingents from all of these community organizations and university groups, high school groups, family groups, church groups, union groups. And my particular beat on this is trying to get the unions more engaged. And we're moving along so well. One of the great features of this march is that it is led by frontline communities. That is, communities that are most affected by climate change, communities that were most affected by Superstorm Sandy. A large number of people who were thrown out of their homes during Superstorm Sandy still haven't been relocated. Their homes have not been repaired, and that's pretty shocking. So we need to get people back into their homes and repair the damaged NYCHA housing. NYCHA, that is the New York City Public Housing Authority, they have a huge stock of really solid housing that needs to be repaired and refurbished and maintained. That's the bulk of affordable housing that we really need to be advancing. We also need to be investing in the retrofitting of the large buildings in New York City. Large buildings in New York City account for over 70% of the carbon emissions in New York City. In most places, it's cars. And certainly cars, vehicular traffic contribute close to the other 30%, and that's very significant. We want to change that definitely. But the big buildings are the main source of air pollution and carbon in New York City. And we could create a huge jobs program. We could be training people, particularly from communities that are underserved and are most affected by climate change. We could be training people from those communities to do those jobs. So it could be a big jobs effort. And that could be a very beautiful way of creating part of what we're calling a just transition to renewable energy and to reduce carbon emissions. So,
what kind of things are they proposing to do in these large buildings? Like put green roofs on them, or photovoltaic windows, or what kind of improvements are they hoping to do with the job training program?
Well, a lot of it has to do with the heating and cooling systems. That's the big one. A lot of those buildings are still using, or they're using all fossil fuels, for example. They need to make that transition, but they also need to clean up these very old systems that are spewing carbon. So a lot of it is basic retrofitting for what they have already, and of course adding, wherever possible, solar panels and green roofs, absolutely, and new windows. Uh-huh. All of those are factors. There's a long list of these changes that need to be made. But these are changes that need to be made by people who are trained in, not in the necessarily very high-tech fields, but in what we would call construction trades. And there are a lot of people that need jobs. This could be a massive job effort, and it could be targeted at communities that really need that work. So we're very excited about that. We'd like them to be good union jobs, because unless you have a union, you don't have a good job. Unions protect jobs, and it's really important. Another big demand that we have, where we're wanting to get the survivors back in their homes, where we're wanting to halt all developments on waterfront properties, because it's crazy to be building on the waterfront when we know that the sea level will rise. We need to be able to have building codes that are going to protect not only the buildings, but the public purse from having to save those buildings. We should not be building in areas that are going to be most affected by climate change. So that's
right.
Another big one. And just sort of connected to that, New York City is a city that is right on the ocean. It's right on a river. We are a coastal city, and we have we're a bunch of islands outside of the Bronx. It's all islands, and even the Bronx is heavily affected by rising tides and by hurricanes. So we know that that's going to happen. We know that the waters will rise many feet, and we're not doing very much about it. We're so far doing almost nothing about it. We know that the hurricanes will keep coming, and we need to be resilient, and we need to protect ourselves, but we also have to do our share to minimize carbon emissions so that we have a future.
I know. They're doing, you know, they have made some efforts, but like you said when we were talking earlier, it's so minimal. You had mentioned something about the Big U. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is?
Well, it's an enormous multi-billion dollar construction plan to basically create a semicircle around Lower Manhattan to protect it from storm surge, and it will take 10 years to finish it. It's an enormous public works project that should be supported. I think it's a great idea. But what about the Rockaways? What about Long Island? What about Staten Island? What about Coney Island? They're not going to be affected at all by this Big U. We need to have a more comprehensive plan that looks at the city as a whole. Now, I know that Mayor de Blasio has in his heart and in his speech the desire to help working people and poor people. I don't doubt that intention. But we can't just protect Lower Manhattan. We know who lives. I mean, the Lower East Side certainly has a more diverse population, but Lower Manhattan is Wall Street. You know, Wall Street, Battery, City Park, of course they should be protected. But what about all those families and all those people, and mostly people of color, by the way, who are in the low-lying areas? This is true all over the world. They need the protection. You know, I think there's been a real game change over the last several weeks when people have seen what devastation can happen. I think what's going on in Puerto Rico is just totally astounding. Just wiped out the agriculture there, wiped out every home that wasn't made of cement. The poor people were the ones that were most affected by Hurricane Maria. And that was true in St. Martin's, in the U.S. Virgin Islands. It's true in Mexico from the earthquakes. It's poor people who end up paying the price of climate change. And we need to be very comprehensive in our climate change, in both prevention and resilience, and in decreasing carbon emissions. And, you know, during World War II, we had this, you know, the Manhattan Plan, where we saw an emergency to end the war during World War II. And we developed the atom bomb, right? Wonderful, a wonderful outcome. I'm saying that very sarcastically, but
I know.
they saw it was important to have that. And so they threw huge resources into the development of the atom bomb, and they were able to do it in a very short period of time. The whole mobilization for World War II happened very quickly and very effectively. We need that kind of mobilization. The Nazi threat was enormous. I don't want to minimize that. But the threat of climate change is much, much, much greater. Because if we don't act immediately on climate change, and we have a very narrow window, really, of 10 to 12 years, where we need to change our energy system to 100% renewable globally, if we don't start doing that, what we will see is hitting those tipping points for climate change that we won't be able to come back from. And that will make the planet ultimately unlivable for humans. Other species may survive it, but our species will not. So we have to stop, you know, sending our grandchildren little tchotchkes and that kind of thing. And we have to start putting our energy behind climate change policy. You know, our poor little grandchildren are going to have tough lives if we don't turn this around.
You know, so and it's so
scary.
That's
why I'm putting
have,
every minute of my retirement into this.
Well, thank you, Nancy, for doing that work. But it's
a lot of people are doing
scary when we have an administration running this country that still, to this day, does not take the threat of climate change to be real. I mean, Scott Pruitt, who our president has put in charge of the Environmental Protection Agency, did you see that article in the New York Times a couple of days ago? He has spent the first 15 days of his administration in May. He met with the executives of every like chemical company, president of Shell Oil, the chief executive of Southern Company, the Farm Bureau. I mean, he just met with, toy associations, cement associations. He did not meet with one environmental activist, environmental organization at all. I mean, he is, a person that has wanted to dismantle the Environmental Protection Agency back before he was in charge of it. It's so scary.
Well, it is, and I think that clearly there's a for sale sign on the federal government. There's no doubt, step up and, tell us what you want us to do, from the NRA to the Koch brothers to, Energy Transfer Partners to all of these different groups that are now getting everything they want out of the federal government. When people say, Trump is not able to move any legislation, that may be true, but he's moving the most draconian environmental policies and justice policies. So in those two areas alone, he's doing an enormous amount of damage. I think the resistance to Trump is magnificent, and we have to continue it. But it doesn't give the cities and the state the excuse not to move forward. It should give the cities and the states the increased the increased energy to really address the issues when we can. And there's a lot that the cities and the states can do besides talk. We need to see this as an existential crisis that we have to change. And if people like de Blasio and Cuomo want to, quote, get anywhere in our nation in terms of future elections, they need to step forward, as climate. They need to show what they can do on a city and state level, and others will follow. I just want to say one thing about, our elected officials and what they can do, and this is directed at our controller, Scott Stringer, who personally I like very much. I have a lot of respect for him, but he's not moving on one of the big demands that we have that he could be moving on. That is that the New York City Public Worker Pension Fund have close to $4 billion invested in fossil fuel stocks.
How now, much?
Almost $4 billion.
Wow.
It's a lot of money. We have a very large divest from fossil fuels movement that's going on in New York City, in New York State, all over the country, all over the world. Governments, universities, various stock portfolios are divesting from fossil fuels. Churches, synagogues are divesting from fossil fuels for two reasons. One is that fossil fuels are a bad investment. Everyone knows they're going down. They've been decreasing in value over the last several years compared to the overall stock index. So it makes pension funds, hardworking New York City public worker pension funds, more vulnerable. And when they take a nosedive, when those fossil fuel stocks take a nosedive, which all the financial advisors admit they will, New York City has too many rules about how, that to protect the pension funds, but doesn't allow the pension funds to move quickly. So when they see this happening, to quickly drop those stocks. So we are not, quote, nimble in that way. So it's important for us to see how much money is going to be going down the drain and will harm New York City workers. But the other reason, and for me it's even a bigger reason, is that it's so immoral for hardworking New York City workers to have their pension funds supporting the fossil fuel industry, something that's going to destroy the future for their progeny, for their grandchildren, for their great-grandchildren. Why would we want our money to go to such a destructive force? Fossil fuels are the most destructive force on Earth. Why should I have any of my money invested in that? And they're not as valuable as they used to be. So we have this big movement now pushing the controller and all of the people who sit on the city pension boards, and there are five different pension boards. We are asking for those fossil fuel stocks to be dropped from the portfolio. And we're hoping to accomplish that certainly in the next several months.
Oh, I hope so. Send me that information. I'll help share that with people, too, to push their, Scott Stringer in that direction. I know the city of Seattle divested completely from all fossil fuels, and I believe there's some other cities, too. But I know, Seattle did.
Well, I think one of the really important things on climate change policy, including divestment, is setting a timeline. You know, one of the problems that's been going on with de Blasio and with Cuomo is there's no timeline. And then when you look at it, you have to have milestones. You know, every single year you have to say how much you're going to decrease so you can get to that final 100% renewable energy or 100% retrofitting for the buildings or 100% survivors of Sandy back in their homes. If you don't have a timeline, then things just start falling apart. So we need to have a timeline with all of these policies, but we also need a timeline for divestment. So our resolution for the New York City pension funds is to 100% divestment from all fossil fuel stocks in the top 200 fossil fuel stocks, which are almost all of them, but those are easy to name, within a five-year period after they make the decision to divest. So we're not talking about instant divestment because that is very destabilizing to a massive fund. But we need to start making those milestones so that we actually address this existential threat.
Yeah, and I'm surprised that it hasn't started to happen already. I mean, like you said, this divestment push has been going on for 5 years now. I mean, I remember, Bill McKibben years ago with his, do the math tour that he did and, getting all the schools to start divesting from fossil fuel companies. And I've been pushing my alma maters and, it's been a big push for a while. So I'm surprised that it's just reaching New York now. But Nancy, let's take a couple minute break. And when we come back, let's talk a little bit more about the march and ways that people can get involved. Okay. So everyone listening, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Nancy Romer from Sandy 5 Organization, and you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green. Be right back.
Best choice for voices outside the mainstream. PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello. This is Dane Wigington, host for the weekly Global Alert News Hour from GeoengineeringWatch.org. I'm grateful and honored to now be a part of the PRN Radio Network lineup. Every Saturday at 2 p.m. on the Global Alert News Hour, I'll cover the most dire frontline issues and stories which pose the greatest and most immediate threat to us all and to the biosphere on which we depend to support the web of life. I'll stitch these stories together to form a coherent picture of what's unfolding and why, and what each of us can do to help alter the human race's current course of genocide and ecocide. Join me on the show every Saturday at 2 p.m. for a crystal clear look at the ominous horizon that lies before us.
The story behind the story, your story, my story, is all in the mix on Lead Stories right here on PRN.FM. This is Eutrice Lead inviting you to share your thoughts and opinions and expand your knowledge about critical issues of the day, Monday through Friday, right after Gary Null's show. Listen live to a broadcast or get Lead Stories whenever you want from PRN's archive. You can even rate the show on iTunes. Now pass the word. Tell this story to everyone you know. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Stay tuned to PRN, your source for the best in progressive radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and my guest is Nancy Romer from Sandy 5 Organization, talking about the march coming up in a few weeks on October 28th. Nancy, you with me?
I am. Hi.
Great. So, so we were just talking about, divesting and how that can help, deal with some of the climate crisis that we're dealing with. One of my feelings is that there's been so many marches since the People's Climate March. We've had the Women's March on Washington, and then the Science March, and there's so many marches. What happens after the marches? Do you see, since you're much more involved in the steering committee and the organization of it, what happens after the marches? Do you feel like that there's some residual change that happens from these marches? Because, as a person who is not on the steering committees but certainly goes to the marches, of course, like so many people, you get discouraged when you feel like you're going to a march after march after march and you're not seeing any changes. So can you share with us, some of the behind-the-scenes action that's happening as a result of some of these marches?
Sure. I think you're right that, the closer into the center you go, the more you see the effects. And it's hard to communicate it out because some of it's somewhat subtle, but necessary. I think what the marches do is they develop infrastructure, organizational infrastructure, within the coalitions that build the marches. So you get a group of, let's say in our case, 70 organizations that have had relationships before, but this strengthens those relationships, that the planning for the march, the organizing for the march, they solidify relationships and plan for the future. And it helps to focus all of these groups on the demands that the march is making. And that's very important because a lot of the organizations may not have climate policy or climate issues as their main focus, but this raises it and allows the marches allows these organizations to see how they can weave in the demand for accelerated climate policy to be woven into their day-to-day struggles. They see the connections, and that's very important. So the infrastructure of the movement is very important. Mm-hmm. Also, it has a big effect on politicians. There's no doubt about it. They see it. They know it. They start moving on policy. Look, almost all the politicians are going to be bowing to the corporations. We know that. It's totally obvious and despicable on a federal level. But even on a city and state level, it happens more than it should. We have to be that counterweight to say the people are watching, the people are knowing, we want to see change now. And we do see, more and more effort going on. I mean, we've seen the mayor's new climate policies. I don't think they're adequate. I think they're too little, too slow, too long a timeline. I think changing the citywide greenhouse emissions by 7%. The mayor's target now is to reduce citywide greenhouse emissions 7% by 2035. That's nothing. That's crazy.
Right.
7% right. by 2035? I mean, that's like nothing. We need
right.
to really move it. And so, you know, these, the movements push. They push and are effective in getting something out there. And the more we push, the more we get. Because, you know, let these, look, we know that de Blasio is going to win. He's not under fire in terms of his job. But if he wants to advance, how does he want to advance? Does he want to be known as the climate mayor, which will make him a great hero 4 years from now for his next step up, whatever it may be? If mm-hmm. he's known as someone who has, I mean, because climate is going to be the main issue that's going to be facing us as we move forward.
Well, you know, when you're talking about all the coalitions coming together, climate issue really has to become the number one for all of them. I mean, I'm involved in, you know, food and food policy and, you know, non-GMO and organic and all this. But the reality is, if we don't deal with climate change, we're not growing food. We're going to be dead. You know, there's going to be no planet. And so, you know, climate change really has to be moved up to the top.
There will be a planet. We just won't be on it.
Right, of course.
That's the thing. The planet Earth will continue with other species, but we will. We may not be able to survive as a species unless we can turn this around. You know, I think that the question of agriculture and food is a very important one that is too often ignored in the climate movement. And it's one that, like you, Bhavani, I care a lot about. By the way, there's going to be a food and farm justice contingent at the demonstration on October 28th. And that will be wonderful. The New York City Community Garden Coalition is organizing that contingent. And we will be meeting, all of us, everyone in the march, will be meeting at Cabman Plaza in Brooklyn Heights on Saturday morning, October 28th at 11 a.m. And we'll be marching across. We'll find our contingents, and then we'll march across the Brooklyn Bridge to the Smith Houses on the Lower East Side. I just want to also mention that the website is Sandy, S-A-N-D-Y, and then the number 5. So it's sandy5.org, and a great way to plug in. I want to say something about agriculture. So we saw in Puerto Rico that there's no more agriculture now. It's gone. We've seen huge numbers of community gardens in Superstorm Sandy, also gone. What do we do? We also know that, for example, in Puerto Rico, all of the electric grid is basically destroyed.
Gone, right.
What do we do with that? Well, one of the things we do is we take a step back and not just jump in and let agribusiness grab the land or let the gas and oil interests grab back the electric grid, but to rethink how can Puerto Rico, how can New York, how can everywhere in the world be truly energy independent, and that is through building solar energy on the rooftops of every single house that's reconstructed. That way it's permanent, and the people have control over it. They don't have to import fossil fuels because an island like Puerto Rico has no fossil fuels on it. And so they could be creating solar panels and wind turbines that would, and they have plenty of sun. Anyone who's been to Puerto Rico or the Caribbean in general knows there's plenty of sun and plenty of wind.
And plenty of wind.
Yeah, and let those be the sources of energy. Why would you rebuild a 20th century energy system in the 21st century? It just doesn't make any sense, except mm-hmm. for the fossil fuel interests that are, you know, chomping at the bit to grab back that money. Agribusiness, this should be a moment where Puerto Ricans, I mean, I have no right to say what the Puerto Ricans should be demanding, but I would say if I were Puerto Rican and I was there demanding, I would be demanding land reform. Let's make sure that there are smaller parcels of land for Puerto Rican farmers who are quite expert to use agroecological or organic methods to have an agriculture that's going to be healthy for the planet and healthy for the people of Puerto Rico. They've got plenty of land to do that, and if they're going to be rebuilding the agriculture there, it needs to be done on a much smaller scale and give the power to the farmers that are working the land, not to agribusiness that's going to extract profit from it and use the worst agricultural methods to grow food. You know, I was in March of this year, I visited farms in Peru that were it was a network of farms, about 40,000 farmers who have agroecological practices or organic practices, and are learning how to generate their own solar panels, their own solar energy and wind energy. And this is very much a person-to-person teaching experience. It's run by Sierra Sostenible, and which is a nonprofit in Peru. It's vast, and they will be able to feed their people. Agribusiness will not be able to feed our people. They're going to add emissions into the carbon emissions into the air, and ultimately those massive farms will not survive.
I agree.
So, you know, there's a lot to do. There is this, you know, challenge and opportunity. There are some opportunities to remake systems that are sustainable and are truly 21st century systems. And we can do that in New York, too, in terms of saving gardens and saving permeable soil so that water can be absorbed rather than just flooding.
Mm-hmm. I know. You know, there's so much... so many possibilities if people step back and try to think through innovation and creativity in trying to tackle some of these huge problems. But when you just keep doing the same old thing, business as usual, and selling out to the big corporations that make the big donations to your campaigns, it's really tough. And it's so tough as someone, you know, that watches it happen over and over and not getting discouraged. I admire your resilience so much because you've been working at this for, you know, most of your adult life, and as have I. But it's just enormous, and it does get discouraging sometimes, I must admit.
But you know,
what do you do with that when you get feel discouraged, or do you not?
I don't. I just tell a very short story that I think sort of explains some of this. We were doing a community screening of a gorgeous new film, a documentary called Chasing Coral, on the death of the coral reefs. It's, of course, visually gorgeous because coral reefs are gorgeous, but they're dying. And they help to produce a lot of protein for billions of people, but they also mitigate climate. They pull carbon from the atmosphere and bring it into the oceans, and that's all going to end soon because the oceans are too warm. That's what's killing the coral roots.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, Chasing Coral is the name of it, and you can get it on Netflix. So we were doing a community screening, and at the end we had a discussion, and half the people were very depressed by seeing Chasing Coral, and the other half were very energized by it. And it was to a person, the people who were not active in the climate movement or in anything else felt very depressed by looking at the reality of what's going on with the oceans. The people who are activists were energized by it. This is important information. Look what we're doing now. We're having this effect. We're having that effect. We have these organizations. We're working with terrific people who are putting their great energies and their great ideas to this problem. You meet people who are exciting and powerful in their presence. When you're not an activist, the world is overwhelming. When you are an activist, you figure out a small pathway, whether it's contributing time and money sporadically or whether it's really committing yourself to ongoing organizations. The more you commit, the more energy and positive feelings you have because you're seeing all the people engaged in these changes. So I'm not depressed because I see
that's great.
A vibrant movement. I feel I owe it to the world. I've had a really good life. I've had so many advantages. I have a home. I've raised kids. they're educated and launched. I mean, you know, I've taught thousands of wonderful young people at Brooklyn College. I've been a member of a wonderful union, Professional Staff Congress of CUNY. You know, I've had so many advantages. I feel I owe and I want to give back to the world that has given me so much. And that's, to me, that's a part of living a good life. It may not be for everyone, but for me, it's a key part. So yeah. I'm hoping that everyone's going to come out on Saturday, October 28th, to the Sandy 5 climate march, and we want to hold our public officials accountable and move them faster.
Well, I will be there, and I hope most of my listeners will be there. It's you know, it's just a wonderful note to end on, to in that positivity of take the action, and then you will feel energized by surrounding yourself with other activists that are moving this movement forward. And that is just a beautiful thing. So, Sandy, thank you so much. Thank you for all your work. Thank you for joining me this morning so last minute. We will see you again on, what is the date, October 24th, was it? You know, you'll come back on and tell us a little bit more of how the planning's going so that we can get everybody out there.
Great.
So,
and
thank you, Nancy.
Just remember, for your food justice activists, please remember that there will be a food and farm justice contingent organized by the New York City Community Garden Coalition.
So when they get to Cabin Plaza, how would they find that contingent? Because I want to know.
I think they're
will
going
there be
to,
signs?
Well, it will probably be posted on either the New York City Community Garden Coalition website or on the sandy5.org website. But at this moment, I think they're going to be meeting at the in front of the Cabin Plaza Library. I think that will be their meetup point. But people can also look around and see gorgeous posters of fruits and vegetables. And they'll know, oh, that's my strawberry. I'm going there.
Right. Well, I'll find out the information, too, and post it on my website for sure.
Great. Okay. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome. Everyone who's been listening with us, thank you so much for joining us. It's been wonderful, and I hope you all come out on October 28th for the Sandy 5 March. See you then, and have a great rest of the week. Bye for now.